Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Welcome to WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. This is the hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, and you're listening to the Jazz and Justice listener-supported station that's 48 years old, thanks to listeners like yourselves providing social and financial support. For that, I am grateful and I welcome you. Today's topic, the District of Columbia. The People's Initiatives, plural, for Self-Determination, Governance, and Living. Our guests today are Dr. MJ Rimsha Poloska. She's an associate professor of history at American University and an interdisciplinary cultural historian of the 19th and 20th century U.S. history. Her research interests include public history, museum studies, historiography, and visual and material culture, among many topics. She is the author of History Comes Alive, Public History and Popular Culture in the 1970s. Our other guest is Elliot Mamet. Dr. Mamet is a postdoctoral research associate and lecturer at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. He also has served as an American Political Science Association Congressional Fellow. Dr. Mamet's interest in democratic equality in the U.S. and the ways in which boundaries are created and reinforced by political institutions. He holds his PhD from Duke University. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, David. Nice to be with you.
And thank you. And if I could, may I call you Elliot?
Yes, absolutely.
And MJ, I was trying to do my best pronouncing your beautiful Polish surname. Could you just go ahead and repeat it for our listeners? I really want them to register it.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. It's Rimsha Poloska.
Okay, Rimsha Poloska.
Yeah.
I think. Let's just, I'll serve as the an introduction here. The District of Columbia got its name because it was chosen in 1791 by commissioners tasked with planning a new national capital. And it was originally set up at supposedly George Washington's direction for 100 square miles, post-Civil War that went down to 68, and the reasons for that we'll explain in our conversation. And to make it official, Congress passed in 1801 the Organic Act of 1801, which, broadly speaking, officially establishes the District of Columbia under the control of Congress. Now, before 1874 and after 1973, loosely speaking, in fact, you read this in many places, Congress allowed certain powers of government to the District of Columbia. So we'll just start off with that. But both of you offer some important lessons from history and political science regarding the people who reside here. MJ, you started out a panel with looking at the summer of 1972, and upon that occasion, a bicentennial assembly was formed. Can you just begin our story?
Yeah, absolutely. So just for background, this is a panel from the DC History Conference, which happened last weekend. Elliot and I were on a panel with like everybody else in Washington, DC who does history. It's really a fabulous event. And we had the pleasure of having this amazing conversation. But what for me, so this is research I've been doing for about a year and a half. So because the semiquincentennial is coming up, the 250th, I got people, and I'm a person who writes about commemoration. I had written about the national bicentennial in my book. And so people started talking and asking me what they thought that DC should do for the semiquincentennial. And I thought to myself, well, what did DC do for the bicentennial? Now, there's one story, which is the story I think that we all know, or we think that we know, which is that there were fireworks on the Mall and a bunch of museums opened and there was a National Folklife Festival. Some people might also know that there was an effort to, this came in the midst of an effort to renovate Union Station into the Washington Visitor Center. If you have been here long enough, you remember it probably. It was not a success. There was also the Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon administrations had been trying also to renovate the Federal Triangle and particularly Pennsylvania Avenue, which at that point was kind of a lot of working class businesses that federal interests were invested in making it more of a kind of ceremonial thing. So that's one federal story of the bicentennial. What I'm interested in, however, is the local story of the bicentennial, which is far more exciting and I think far more relevant for our times and says a lot about who Washingtonians are and who Washingtonians have always been. So essentially, and that was a very, very long introduction, but essentially, DC had been kind of trying, much in the same way that we are now trying to figure out what we're doing for the semiquincentennial, DC had been trying by and by, and commemorations take a long time to plan. So even though this was happening in 1976, they really started talking about it in 1968, 1969. So the first thing that happened is a bunch of business interests in DC. So you might know that prior to Home Rule, the people who had a lot of power in DC were boosters and businessmen and developers. So there's two kind of key organizations, the Federal City Council and the Board of Trade, that sound like they're governments, but they're not. They're like chambers of commerce with a lot of connections to federal power. So essentially, these guys had been kind of trying to plan a convention center. They had been trying to plan renovations, stuff for tourists, essentially. But in DC at this time, basically starting in the 1960s, just a ton of activists had been coming to the city. There was a real sense among people all over the nation, and this is important, that DC was the place that things were going to happen. So people from the Black Freedom Struggle, so people like Marion Barry, people like Stokely Carmichael, people from the anti-war movement, LGBTQ activists, you know, all kinds of activists were coming and staying in DC. A lot of them found jobs through war and poverty programming, so had federal jobs, had kind of like think tanky jobs, had these new non-for-profit jobs. at the same time, too, there were all of these kind of local housing organizers, welfare organizers, tenants' rights organizers who had spent the entire 60s fighting back against urban renewal and development. So essentially, to take this back to the bicentennial, what happens is, you know, in 1971, 1972, there's a vacuum. No one can seem to get anything off of the ground. So a lot of these local activists get together and say, well, why don't we plan a bicentennial? And why don't we plan a bicentennial that is for Washington, that fits many of, you know, that is addressing many of the most pressing needs, housing needs, education needs, jobs, infrastructure, arts, culture. And why don't we, you know, use this to make Washington an example for all the land, essentially. So the story that I'm interested in telling is this kind of grassroots bicentennial assembly that came up against the backdrop of home rule. This is the kind of important part. So a lot of my story is both what this looks like as a commemoration, but also how this is happening while all the very same people are kind of getting invested and interested in electoral politics in a new way.
Well, thank you for that overview. I think you're pointing to two distinct problems here, if correct me if I'm wrong. There's the idealization of Washington, D.C. being not only the nation's capital, but the world's capital. Mm-hmm. Some commentators say Washington, D.C. is truly what would be called a post-industrial town. It's not in the public arena, the larger arena, acknowledged by definitions of industry or ethnicity, even though those are realities. It's defined more by government as an abstraction, I guess, the military and information technology sector. For the most part. So you have this tension between what the District of Columbia could be and should be locally versus some sort of national idea and under the control of different people. One translation of that as we look through the history and the politics is basically issues of control. What do we do with a majority Black population at different points of the history of this city, this municipality, this District of Columbia? And you cite it, and I hope both of you and Elliot mentioned key players and different individuals. I think we alluded to, or you mentioned Marion Barry, of course, who, by the way, besides his local activism, served on the Board of Education before his ascendancy to mayor. So you have all the benefits of, how can I say it, the convulsions of the 60s going into the 70s. Johnson's Great Society, as you cited, the March on Washington. And generally, through hard times, people are hopeful. So you mentioned home rule, and that's what we'll get into with both you and Elliot. The Home Rule Act was passed in December of 1973, and there's a pretense that people of Washington can govern themselves, but President Nixon had one idea and the people of D.C. had another. Tell us more about what evolved into what was called the Bicentennial Assembly.
Right, yeah. So the Bicentennial Assembly is... So essentially, when to go back to the bicentennial, right? So in 1972, the city announces a new kind of people-powered bicentennial that Mayor Walter Washington had agreed to because of advocacy by multiple activists.
Do that because he was the first elected mayor, not appointed.
He was not elected yet. He was appointed. Yeah, he was. Part of the reason that he did this is because he wanted to get elected. That he had. Was appointed. He was appointed through the Johnson and the Nixon. And so, you know, like his reputation in D.C. is like the guy that Nixon appointed. You know, he himself has really long D.C. vote divides. You know, he goes to Howard. He's involved in protest in the 40s. Like this is But at the same time, he has kind of like the taint of the Nixon appointee on him, with a lot of the kind of most the people, the sort of rising political power in DC, which is progressive, which is, you know, invested in self-determination. And so one of the reasons that Washington goes along with this and kind of aligns himself with this effort is to differentiate himself from kind of the more federal Washington, which had invest, you know, which had vested his power. So Washington goes along with this. It's not clear to me kind of what his actual feelings on this were. From the historian's perspective, the kind of archives for this are scattered in a lot of different places. And so there's a lot of stuff missing. And, you know, any historian can tell you that researching this kind of stuff is difficult. So I don't quite know what the sort of, what Walter Washington's actual position on this is, but he kind of publicly endorses it. So in early 1972, they announced two new bodies. One is the DC Bicentennial Commission. And the DC Bicentennial Commission, Marion Barry is on it, by the way. So is Topper Carew of the New Thing. So is John Hechinger. Just like a lot, basically anyone who was a local player in Washington, DC is on this 30-person Washington Bicentennial Commission. That's kind of,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Was Ivanhoe Donaldson part of that commission?
No, he wasn't. So Ivanhoe Donaldson was not, he's one of these people who came to DC. So the Barry person who was the most involved in the Bicentennial, aside from Barry himself, was actually Jim Gibson, who had come out of the Atlanta NAACP and then worked with the National Capital Planning Commission. He was an urban planner, but also very much an activist. So by the early 1970s, he is working at the Potomac Institute, which is a progressive think tank. It doesn't exist anymore, but it's funded by the Taconic Foundation. So he's kind of the leading voice for this people's bicentennial.
Yeah. And the only reason I mentioned Mr. Donaldson is because he was a peace activist, civil rights activist, involved with the Institute of Policy Studies.
Right. That's the other one.
Involved in a lot of local initiatives. I just want to give people an explanation of the name.
Yeah, this is the thing. So Ivanhoe Donaldson, again, if you've been in DC for a long time, he was Barry's right-hand man throughout his first administration. He comes from New York to Washington, D.C. I have from the archives at Swarthmore College. Swarthmore has that before he came to D.C., he was involved in the MOBE, so the New York-based anti-war organization. And at some point, he writes them this amazing letter where he's like, I resign and I'm moving to D.C. because I no longer just want to come to D.C. and protest. I think that the struggle's there and that's what I'm going to get involved with. So Ivanhoe Donaldson is another one of these people who's kind of, you know, he's a good example of these people who are in this world right now. A lot of those people end up going into federal government. And those are the kind of people that end up on the Bicentennial Commission or working with the Bicentennial Commission. The other body, the one that I spend a lot more time studying, is the Bicentennial Assembly. So if the commission is people who are kind of already pretty prominent in local DC politics and, you know, any kind of DC politics, the Bicentennial Assembly is a 200 plus person body. Some of them appointed, but some of them are elected in hyper local elections by service area. So DC doesn't have wards yet. It has service areas, which is essentially the same thing. They just go up a little higher. The Bicentennial Assembly is this democratic body, 200 plus people who are all going to work together and come up with bicentennial activity for the city to do. Something that's interesting is that at this time, they think that they're going to get, they have been promised $18 million from Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon has announced in a speech to Congress in multiple interviews that he is going to give Washington, D.C. $18 million to do whatever they want with for local initiatives. So that's part of the impetus for this Bicentennial Assembly, that they have money to spend down on whatever they want. And they also have lots of ideas. And these are just people that come from so many different, you know, these are housing activists. These are, you know, like people who work in nonprofits, people who work in kind of democratic politics, people who come specifically from the Black freedom struggle, anti-war activists. So the reason I'm interested in the Bicentennial Assembly is that it just represents this amazing conglomeration of like every type of Washingtonian that wants to see, wants, you know, neighborhood organizers, old people, young people. There's a great quote from someone on the Bicentennial Assembly who says, well, as long as the bicycle riders and the dashiki wearers can stay together, then, you know, we're going to have our local bicentennial. So, yeah, you have this great group of people.
MJ, allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to MJ Rimshaw-Polowska.
Yeah, you got it.
Just want to enunciate for a change. She's the Associate Professor of History at American University, and we'll be joined by her friend and colleague also, Elliot Mamet. And you're listening to We the People. This hour is dedicated on this Emancipation Day for Washington, D.C., on a bit of Washington history involving governance and living, people's initiatives. We're talking across disciplines, but we're trying to understand the history and politics of how DC residents have historically and continue to struggle and strive to form a life for themselves under the shadow of national politics. Thank you for listening. MJ, the one thing that you revealed in your presentation and in your work also is this People's Assembly, very mindful of what's currently happening to them. They're meeting in libraries, community centers, very public places. But they are reinforced by concern for local news and communication. Mm-hmm. And so there's a grassroots newspaper called the Century Post that plays a very important role in this effort.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. So the Bicentennial Assembly are active from, you know, 1972 when they're formed through 1975, where essentially the money runs out. But during that time, they do a lot of different things. And the thing that I think is one of the, you know, they host neighborhood celebrations, they do advocacy, they submit, you know, tens of different budgets and requests to the local government, to the federal government. They do voter education because, of course, this is all happening during the push for home rule. But they also publish a community newspaper called the Century Post. And speaking from a historian, where this is the reason I think I'm able to be so enthusiastic and have a great understanding of what the Bicentennial Assembly did is because they created this amazing record of it. That so they published this newspaper, you know, pretty regularly, pretty every couple of months. And it talked about, you know, it was available for free. It was bilingual. It was written by student journalists sometimes. It was written by assembly members themselves. And it was just a rundown of everything that was going on in Washington, D.C., every kind of political challenge that's going on, all the things that the different service areas are doing, what are the different initiatives for the Bicentennial Assembly, what they're asking for the federal government, what, you know, home rule legislation looks like. So really, you know, it's, we talk a lot about the kind of sunsetting of local media these days. And I think one of the things that the Bicentennial Assembly really wanted to do is get every Washingtonian civically involved. You know, so they themselves are 200 plus people, but what they wanted is thousands of people. You know, they really, this idea of self-determination, they took it seriously and literally. And part of that is knowing about what is going on the world around you. So yeah, having this community newspaper was really important for them, and in some ways is certainly kind of one of the most tangible legacies of that era.
And the Century Post, that's S-E-N-T-R-Y Post.
That's right, yeah. It's a pun.
So for people know. Well, we've been keeping our friend Elliot in the waiting here, and before we get a break, I at least want to give part of the preview and a some sense of continuity. So for a moment, we're going to leave the 70s and get into the 1990s. Elia Mamet, thank you for being with us. You know, we've been just talking and repeatedly saying home rule, home rule, and the struggle and striving either for full enfranchisement, full representation in on a national level, because the District of Columbia is part of the United States, or statehood is a precarious one at any given moment. But the story you have from the 1990s is one of at least a partial success. Can you explain some sense of success or progress, and who did it come from?
When we talk about home rule, David, we're often talking about DC's limited local self-government. And what MJ is showing here is some of the early history of what that self-government looked like in the district. But there's a whole other piece, which is DC's representation within the halls of Congress. And that's what I'm very interested in. You know, the District of Columbia has had a non-voting delegate to Congress. We had one briefly during Reconstruction in the 1870s. And then we had one starting in 1971 with Walter Fauntroy. The third ever delegate from the District of Columbia was Eleanor Holmes Norton, and she was elected in 1990. And what I'm interested in my paper that I presented at the DC History Conference is the ways that Delegate Norton, newly elected to Congress, looked at the institution of Congress and saw ways that she might be able to aggrandize her role and gain some power within the chamber.
And as you said, we are living at the behest of Congress, the will of the Congress and the president. Not a bill, not a piece of legislation, not a budget is in effect or fully enacted until it meets with the approval of Congress and the president, unless they don't act. And then that's another story for another comment. We're quickly approaching the halfway point of our show. And Elliot, thank you for at least giving us the preamble to what we'll get into further with you and MJ. I'm going to ask that we take a brief break, but that our listeners stay with us. And you're about to hear a public service announcement very relevant to the topic at hand today. Stay with us. We'll be back shortly, and thank you.
Greetings, family. This Wednesday, April 16th, friends, neighbors, and comrades from all across the Washington area will assemble at Metropolitan AME Church for a DC Emancipation Day speak out to strategize, organize, and mobilize from 5:30 until 9 p.m. The event, Standing Together to Fight the Power, presented by the Metropolitan Washington Council, AFL-CIO, and the Federal Unionist Network, together with Harriet's Wildest Dreams, Free DC, The Washington Informer, and WPFW, will center how the community can protect DC home rule, save federal jobs and services, and support the city's most vulnerable neighborhoods. Metropolitan AME Church is located at 1518 M Street Northwest in D.C. Details at wpfwfm.org and freedcproject.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. You're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM. WPFWFM.org. There are over 100 programmers that bring you jazz and justice, particularly on the public affairs side. Well, that's the column I belong to. A lot of programmers put their shows available on various social media platforms. Plus, there is an archive page at WPFWFM.org. You have plenty of good reasons. Partially because we're trying to build a better communities one broadcast at a time, that we're connected to you, and we're concerned about your neighborhood, your community, your world. That's a demonstration of what Muiza Mutale does at 1 p.m. on Africa Now. I suspect if you're listening to this broadcast live, you'll probably hear some sort of summary or focus on conflicts in the Sudan, if you listen today. That's at 1 p.m. That and many other programmers are making available to you their best efforts from their experience, their knowledge, and their guest. But that all is empowered by you, the listener, when you supply your financial and social support. We need both, and we are grateful for both. So thank you. Elliot Mammoth, let's continue the story of DC's presence in the Congress, particularly the House of the United States. And we started out with Eleanor Holmes Norton's battle to secure the right to vote. How is that understood? How did she achieve that?
Delegate Norton enters Congress in 1991, and she has a very difficult role. Your listeners may know there's 435 members of the House who come from the states. And then there's a group of delegates. At the time, there's five. There's Norton, and then there's non-voting members from Puerto Rico, Guam, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and American Samoa. And
the Mariana Islands.
The Mariana Islands didn't get a delegate until 2008, David.
Okay.
But you're right. So today there's six. These folks have a very unusual job. I call them second-class lawmakers. They serve on committees. They can introduce legislation. They have staff. But on the other hand, they cannot vote on final passage of bills. That key point that determines if a bill becomes a law, they have no vote. And so Norton joins the Congress in 1991. She came up through the Black freedom struggle. She is an acclaimed civil rights lawyer. She was interested in ways that policy could be used to advance power. And she looked around the House and saw an opportunity to expand her role, which would be by voting in the Committee of the Whole. Now, just for your listeners who are not versed in congressional legalese, what that means is that she wanted the vote on amendments to legislation. She couldn't vote on the final passage of legislation. She wasn't a representative from the states, but she thought she should be able to vote on amendments to legislation in the House.
And how can I put that? The reasoning, and she was drawing on legal history. In fact, in Britain, for instance, when members of parliament wanted to battle against the crown, this was a device that was used to really affect the actual laws enacted that affected people. I'm just trying to generalize here.
If any of your listeners have ever been to the House gallery to watch votes, which I recommend everyone in DC do, I think it's just totally fascinating. You can see when the House is in Committee of the Whole because the mace, the symbol of authority, is lowered. Instead of addressing a speaker, members address a chair. The dialogue is a little bit more informal. And the House regularly amends legislation in this parliamentary device called Committee of the Whole. Eleanor Holmes Norton, when she becomes a delegate, looks at this Committee of the Whole procedure and thinks, why can't I have a vote in the Committee of the Whole? I can vote in committees. She can vote to report out legislation in the committee.
She can even introduce it, right? She can even introduce legislation in committees.
Absolutely. And she introduces a heck of a lot of legislation. She sponsors and co-sponsors legislation. And she thought, I can do all these other things. There's nothing unconstitutional about giving me a vote in the Committee of the Whole. So she writes a memo proposing this idea in the summer of 1992. She is assisted by a local constitutional law professor named Jamin Raskin at American University. And Norton sends this memo to Lois Slaughter, who is the chair of the House Rules Committee. And Slaughter is intrigued. This is a very novel idea. It's never been done in 200 years of delegates serving in the House. And so she sends it out for opinions. The House parliamentarian is quite opposed to this idea. He calls it particularly irregular in a memo. The Congressional Research Service is neutral on it. They say it's not apparently unconstitutional. And so Slaughter goes back to Norton and says, well, we've received all these objections. And so Norton, in response, proposes an addendum, which is she can vote in committee of the whole, but if her vote is decisive, it will be thrown out and the House will re-vote without her and the other delegates.
So was there even a protest that was logistically difficult? What were some of the other objections? And then if you please, let's hear about some of the supports for this effort.
There were a range of objections. First of all, most especially among virtually all Republicans, both in Congress and outside, George Will wrote a scathing column calling it a partisan power grab. Newt Gingrich said the Democrats are mugging us. That's the language he used. And actually, I found editorials from across the country staunchly opposed to Norton's gambit. And moderate Democrats, you have to remember at this time, there was still a large proportion of moderate, even conservative Democrats, particularly from the South, were largely opposed. There was also opposition here in DC from statehood activists. And I found records of folks from the statehood party saying, if our delegate to Congress gains additional rights, this will actually set back the cause of DC statehood. But on the other hand, as you say, David, there was widespread support from more moderate establishment figures. The Post came out very strongly in favor of this plan. And most of Norton's colleagues in the Democratic caucus were in favor of the proposal. Her proposal passes the Democratic caucus 170 to 45. And then it, on the floor of the House, it passes with 27 Democratic defections and all Republicans opposed. Some of the objections stem from the fact that the proposal lumped her in with the other territorial delegates. And there was a criticism that the delegates from those territories, their constituents pay no federal income tax, and now they could vote on federal income tax rates on the floor of the House. So the objection really was strongest to giving the territorial delegates a vote in committee of the whole. But there were others who felt that the DC delegate also should not have that vote. But
by the way, Elliot, if I can
interject,
the territories of Puerto Rico, Guam, American Samoa, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and the Northern Mariana Islands, taken together with Washington, D.C., you're talking about 5 million people in total. 5 million people who are controlled by the government of the United States, but yet don't have full representation.
That's correct. 5 million people, overwhelmingly racial and ethnic minorities, none of whom have a voting member of the House, none of whom have any representation whatsoever in the Senate, and the residents of the territories had no right at all to vote in the Electoral College for president. DC residents had that right under the 23rd Amendment. But yeah, this is a group of second-class Americans living in DC and the territories who are structurally disenfranchised in all sorts of ways under the Constitution.
So I want to remind listeners that you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. More importantly, my guest, MJ Rimsha Polovska, forgive me, MJ. She's a cultural historian. Elliot Mamet is a political scientist. We're talking about the District of Columbia People's Initiatives for Self-Determination and Governance. With about, 13 minutes to go, maybe I would invite both of you to interact and say, you've described moments of history. You described how people organize themselves, both in the chambers of Congress, but out on the streets. What kind of legacy do they leave us? What lessons are to be learned? What does that leave us now, as we commonly put? We got a hint from MJ's presentation that that assembly had hints of the infrastructure of what's known as advisory neighborhood commissions, ANCs. Certainly, some of the political dynamics, both positive and negative, are still with us. The fundamental reality that local events have some significance to the residents of DC, and they are influenced by the national control that comes from the Congress. Certainly, that's been our history. Where do we go from here? What are we left with?
Yes, I can start, since if we're going chronologically, I want to mention one thing about home rule and why home rule and self-determination is so incredibly important to this particular cohort of people, which is that if you are a Washingtonian in the 60s and the 70s, and particularly if you're a Black Washingtonian, the government is making decisions that impact your everyday life. Massive redevelopment in Southwest Washington, D.C., the threat of highways displacing people under Nixon.
Freeway.
Yeah, the Southwest Freeway under Nixon, new criminal legislation. No knock was, invented in Washington, D.C. So the stakes for people isn't, abstract. Well, we deserve to have a say over our own lives because that's what the Constitution says. Like, this is actually in practice. Having home rule makes a huge impact on, how people in DC live their lives and who gets to say what happens in DC. So those are the stakes. That's one thing. And that's something that we forget sometimes, I think, because we've had it for so long. Or maybe some people don't forget, but some people do. So that's worth thinking about. The other thing about the Bicentennial Assembly is that it just brought together so many people. Washington, D.C. now, as then, is kind of brimming with activist energy. There are so many discrete movements, some of which talk to each other, some of which don't think that they have anything to say to each other. The thing about the Bicentennial Assembly is that all of these 200 people, they all had really different priorities. Some of them seemed to be in conflict with one another. Some people were interested in preservation. Some people were interested in housing density. Some people are interested in cultural center, so many different things. And they found a way to come up with a sort of policy slate, mostly organized around home rule and self-determination, that could help them advocate with one another. So that's the kind of second big legacy that, if we look at what individual movements look like in DC, how they tap into, their own understanding of what citizen participation is, and the kind of things that they're asking for, I think the Bicentennial Assembly was a great model and something that we need now.
I was thinking this over as I read your work, MJ, and also listening to you now. And what's troubling, though, is with the advent of some modern technology and different senses of media, there's kind of a loss. I mean, you had a grassroots newspaper that was very tactile, that was very expressive what was going on, and that's simply not around. I mean, ANC commissioners, with all due respect to fellow local news sources, they're used as pop-up talking heads for the most part when something horrible happens. The media, I think in part of its function, if not to praise, should remind us of the legacies that the elder care infrastructure in this town is due to a lot of this type of activism. The care for youth in this town is due to a lot of this activism. The realities of all sorts of contentions about development and what's fair to people, what places get paid attention to, get neglected, all that is due to these efforts. And we'll certainly pull Elliot in, but as they make their way in a battle through Congress, it's really the people who are going to implement accountability and some success. You want total success, but at least some increment, some modicum of service-relatedness. All that's kind of, pardon the rant, but all that's, it seems like a bit thrown at a loss for now. It doesn't Things just don't seem to be, the glue is not holding together as much as that beautiful moment presented itself.
Yeah, I mean, it'll look different, right? The thing I always say about, you know, especially as a person who studies a lot of the 60s and the 70s, is everything that we see from that period is itself informed by its larger context, you know, the way, the sort of demands that those people are making, how they relate to one another, how they communicate information, you know, underground newspapers, you know, like massive government funding, welfare infrastructure, all of that is kind of historically specific. I'm an optimist. I'm on the board of Humanities DC, and when we have events, I see so many different types of people out there who care so deeply about, you know, including the DC History Conference, who care so deeply about what is going on in the world around them. I know that energy is there. I see it. Sometimes I even see it on social media, you know, like among all the other toxic stuff, but it's there. I just think we need something like the Bicentennial Assembly to tap into it, and then we'll get our own Century Post. And you're right, maybe it won't be a tactile newspaper, but maybe it will be, I don't know, like an internet site that everyone reads, or I don't know, like postering. But it's there. I think it's definitely there. We just have to kind of figure out what it looks like for us and how it fits into our present day.
And let me draw Elliot into this. You know, I was just thinking about the political science of it all. You know, in the 30s and the 40s, Senator Bilbo was getting actual day-to-day control of the district. Before his time, I mean, you had the quote-unquote snow riots of 1835, where Francis Scott Key was the prosecutor of basically a false construct of the Black population being accused of wrongful things when they were actually abused and oppressed. You know, I just mentioned to MJ the whole thing about youth. The Pearl Affair was one that involved young Black people who tried to escape enslavement. And from after that, through the Civil War period and the taking back of rights and self-control, and I mentioned Senator Bilbo earlier, there just doesn't seem to be any respecting from the Hill to the rest of the city sometimes.
Yeah.
I wonder if you can calibrate that for us a little bit better than my rant.
Well, one way you might put it is that the DC Home Rule Act was the last major legislative accomplishment of the civil rights movement, and that attacks on home rule today, which are plentiful, are an attack on that legacy. But let me also say, David, one lesson we might take from this period I'm describing, which relates to MJ's project as well, which is when I look at the history of the delegates from DC to Congress, the lesson I take away is that they're able to locate power where none is apparent. And so, Walter Fauntroy, for example, used the franc, the ability to send mail for free, to send correspondence all over South Carolina to try to primary out John McMillan, who was the chair of the district committee, which ultimately ushers in home rule. So Fauntroy saw the franc as this tool that he had as a non-voting member of Congress that he could use for power. In the period I'm describing, Eleanor Holmes Norton comes to Congress and sees a committee of the whole vote, and a kind of arcane procedural right, as a way for her to vote on amendments to legislation in the House of Representatives. In the House of Representatives, and astonishingly, she wins that right, and the right is still present in the House rules today. She's voted on literally thousands of amendments to legislation. She's quoted at the time as saying, this is the greatest change for DC since home rule. And she found a dormant power in her position that hadn't been readily apparent. And so the lesson I take away is, for those concerned with autonomy and self-governance and democracy for the District of Columbia, to look for avenues for power where it's not readily apparent, and then to use that power to advance democracy and democratic equality in the district.
I think you're both demonstrating also that it's not just an isolated chapter or a moment, that it's a movement, it's a long-term commitment, one of spirit, of knowledge, of skill, and just plain living, quite frankly. What is to be said about the connection between, I don't want to say burden, but being, you know, the nation's capital, being an international city, and again, real people living out local realities. And by the way, I don't mean to imply in any way that the life experience of the real people are not significant to a larger picture of things. You both have pointed out this odd, it's a modern phenomenon to have two Washingtons, one of Washington, again, the world and nation's capital, and the other, the local District of Columbia. That relegation is something that I think it's fair to say is unacceptable and unfair to people. We've got about 2 minutes for either of you to respond. I don't know how much more we can say.
I mean, I'll say that we're seeing right now the kind of effects of this fallacy that Washington runs on two separate tracks, right? In fact, local and federal Washington have always been deeply, deeply intertwined, not only in, you know, people's everyday lives, you know, like all the people that came to DC, for example, to be civil servants, because that was the best opportunity in the, you know, in during the Great Migration, you know, all of the people who come to DC for kind of federal reasons and get involved in local stuff. This just happens over and over again. And
so this,
you know,
is a mystery right now.
Yeah.
considering the downsizing. I'm so sorry, MJ. But
oh, no, of course. No, that's, you know, that's kind of where I'm going to too. We need to, DC needs to kind of do better PR for itself. We need everyone to know that, you know, we're not separate. Like we are, you know, for better or for worse, we are the nation's capital. We are capital for all of America, but what happens here happens first. You know, they call this a workshop for the nation because this is the place where legislature often gets tested. And so this is why, you know, this is why all those people came to DC in the 1960s, because they knew, right? So yeah, I just want, this is, you know, this is another thing we could do during the semi-quincentennial, is kind of try to tell a story about DC that intertwines the federal and the local in different ways.
Yeah, particularly with federal workers, everybody thinks they're centralized here in Washington, D.C., but the workers that are here are relating to federal workers all throughout the country.
Right, that's right.
And Elliot, again, not to put you on task or on the spot, but looking for these opportunities for power and governance, is there anything particularly similar or inspiring looking from that historical moment that you examine to what's going on now? Just doing a little bit of strategic reiteration with you.
Well, I mean, the observation I have is that since 1801, the Organic Act of 1801, the District of Columbia has been governed by individuals who are not accountable to the District of Columbia, are not elected by DC residents. And so Eleanor Holmes Norton, at the time she's proposing this change, considered it part of a two-track strategy. On the one hand, statehood, and on the other hand, inferior ways to increase DC's autonomy. And I think today we can see with the budget shenanigans from Congress to DC, with all the ways that Congress interferes with DC governance, that short of statehood, the District of Columbia won't be able to fully govern itself. So that's the lesson I take away from this history. And I'm really inspired by the broad movement, both DC and more broadly, to push for statehood.
And with that last word, I thank you both.
Thank MJ, you.
Oh, you're welcome. MJ Rimshaw Polovska and Elliot Mamet, thank you for talking about the concerns of the people of the District of Columbia.
It's been such a pleasure to be on this show. Thank you so much for hosting us. This has been a really great conversation. And yeah, I'm such a huge fan. It's really nice to be here with you all.
Testimony. But let me also thank the listeners who support us. Mike Nasella, our engineer, the News and Public Affairs Department of WPFW. And coming up next, every noon hour during the week, don't forget the blues. I have the pleasure of announcing the Wednesday edition with Clarence the Blues Man Turner. And then throughout the day, be open to 5 minutes before the hour, hearing the latest news from a jazz and justice perspective. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to my guests again for being with us. Perhaps we'll meet again in another week or so. Take care.
Greetings, family. This Wednesday, April 16th, friends, neighbors, and comrades from all across the Washington area will assemble at Metropolitan AME Church for a DC Emancipation Day speak out to strategize, organize, and mobilize from 5:30 until 9 p.m. The event, Standing Together to Fight the Power, presented by the Metropolitan Washington Council, AFL-CIO, and the Federal Unionist Network, together with Harriet's Wildest Dreams, Free DC, The Washington Informer, and WPFW, will center how the community can protect DC home rule, save federal jobs and services, and support the city's most vulnerable neighborhoods. Metropolitan AME Church is located at 1518 M Street Northwest in DC. Details at wpfwfm.org and freedcproject.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Reparations Valley, Saturday, May 17th, a festival of unity and celebration of the ongoing quest for reparations, as well as the 100th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X. Speakers include Michael Eric Dyson, Robin Ruth Simmons, O'Malley Yeshitela, Ajua Ayatoro, with virtual remarks from Marilana Karenga, actress Erica Alexander, and Ben Chavis. Performers include the rapper Razzcaz, along with DC's own Ayanna Gregory, Afi Soul, Lucy Murphy, Nana Malaya and the Malcolm X dancers and drummers, Free Benjamin, Randy Payton, and Laini Mataka. May 17th, Landsberg Park, 1098 Delaware Avenue Southwest, 11 a.m. How we gonna make reparations
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration, on Friday, April 25th, from 7 until 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt, Maryland. Entertainment will be provided by vocalist Navasha Dea and her trio, and WPFW programmers and poets Esther Everam and Zain El Amin. The evening includes an award ceremony, dinner, and dancing to the music of DJ James Funk. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at wpfwfm.org.
Dennis Williams with the WPFW editorial. Kilmar Abrego Garcia, an apprentice sheet metal worker raising three children with his wife in Prince George's County, has been kidnapped by the United States government. On March 12th, Abrego Garcia was pulled over by ICE agents, accused of being a member of the Salvadoran gang MS-13, and then transported to a terrorist confinement center in his native El Salvador. In fact, Abrego Garcia had fled his homeland at 16 because of threats from local gangs, and a U.S. immigration judge in 2019 granted him protection from being deported because he would face persecution if he ever returned. The Justice Department admitted that his removal was an administrative error, and the U.S. Supreme Court ordered the government to facilitate the return of Abrego Garcia, who has never been charged with a crime or found to have any gang affiliation. President Trump shrugged and said that it was up to El Salvador.